Hey everyone, this is Kevin here. I just want to quickly preface before we get into this episode. You might notice by the title, it's a little bit different. We're going to be talking about retro game shopping and the optimal retro gaming experience from, the best televisions to pick up to upscalers to emulation versus the real, hard carts and discs and stuff like that. And again, we basically did this because we weren't able to align schedules since I'm in Japan right now, and things got a little crazy. I didn't want to miss a week though, so this is kind of the compromise that we made to make sure that you guys got something to listen to this week. Other thing I want to quickly mention is that I was a little jet lagged when we recorded this. I now apologize if I sound a little cloudy or anything like that. I did my best, and the final thing is in the first section of the podcast for about 25 minutes. Occasionally there's some like light clicking from, it looks like it was coming from the power converter that I had set up. So that's that. So I apologize for that, but it's still very listenable and I'm just super crazy about the audio quality. So I hope you enjoy it and we'll be back to kind of the regular setup next time. But I thought this would be kind of cool to talk about retro gaming and also the Japanese gaming experience and shopping over here. And yeah, so that's it. So here, let's get into the episode. Hope you enjoy it. And again, thanks as always for listening. Welcome back to Back in My Play, the podcast based on nostalgia for video games and things of the like. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me is Josh Hillier. Trey is on assignment. What's up, Josh?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, what happened is Trey and I were carrying some really old school CRT TVs together, and one fell on his foot, and so he's been sent on assignment to the hospital.
Great. Yeah. No, he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. So we have a really interesting episode for you this week. We're not actually going to be talking about Neo Geo stuff like we originally planned, but instead, since I am in Japan, and this is kind of like one of those things that we've been getting requests and comments about recently, is that, I want to, hook my old consoles back up. I want to start playing these old games. Is emulation the best way to go? Wii, Virtual Console, things like that. What's the best step to take? And also, people were like, "Yeah, we want to I want you to diary the Japanese experience. Talk about what it's like over there. Talk about shopping for retro games." And even like one of the things I was thinking about doing is just like every time I went to a store, I catalog everything and then write a diary about it. But I figured this would make a little bit more sense since we're a podcast and people might not go to the website. So that's what we're going to do. So to basically kind of break this down, we might make this like a multi-part episode. And really we're going to be talking about is retro gaming basics, talking about the best way to get set up, and then really also kind of like the best way to acquire this stuff, because one of the things that I love to talk to you about, Josh, is like I hate, people can go on to insert website, download a zip file with 700 NES ROMs, but I hate that experience because it's like you're just overwhelmed and almost paralyzed by how much stuff you have access to. Where you don't even know what to play, or like you'll just play a game for 5 seconds and move on. So, I think that will be something.
Yeah, I think you're just not as invested inherently, right? Because there was no real thinking that went into downloading 700 games at once. Mm-hmm. So they obviously weren't games that you had on a list to acquire at some point in time. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of exactly. It's sort of the I'll just play it for 20 seconds at a time and then move on. It's like MP3s or something at that point. Mm-hmm. You're just kind of going through your collection, as opposed to some of the stuff that we've gotten to do lately, like playing Shatterhand and really devoting some time to a game that you're personally invested in and interested in playing. And man, these physical cards can look really cool sometimes.
Oh, for sure. And I think like it's not only that, but and also I should preface, if you hear like white noise in the background, it's because I do have an air conditioner on. It is about 100 degrees in Japan right now, not joking, and the humidity is at about 80% today. So otherwise I'd be drenched in sweat and dead. So I'm going to do my best to clean up the audio in post-production, and hopefully everything is loud enough. So let's get into the first main subject of really just kind of like retro gaming basics. So obviously with the retro gaming basic stuff, the first thing that we get to talk about is what you're going to watch this stuff on. And the big thing, literally, is CRTs. If you can if you can get like a CRT, that is going to be golden. Even your better bet is to get something made in about 2003 to 2006, and we're going to be talking about like Sony Vegas, Sony Trinitrons. That is kind of like the gold standard. And even the best thing about this is I worked at Best Buy from 2004 to 2006, like in the off season when I was not at college selling television. So like I got super deep into like the differences between all the brands, talking about like comb filters and talking about different kinds of inputs and the difference between all the manufacturers and stuff like that. And if you want to really make sure you get a great TV, just go with find a Sony Trinitron or get a Toshiba tube TV that was made after 2003. Those are going to be the best of what is still out there, and they really are built to last. Like you're going to pick up a Sony Trinitron and it will still last you for about 20 years as long as you don't drop it. Because the best thing about those tubes is their durability, and not like back then they were made to last, but still in like 2004, they were still doing a really great job with manufacturing those things. So that is
talking about high definition specifically right now, Kevin? I mean, I know obviously these games won't all of a sudden be high definition, but that still might play some factor, right?
Well, yeah, and even like at that time, back in 06 and 07, Sony and Toshiba and Samsung, they were making HD CRTs in the United States. So what that basically is usually the best HD, it depends who you talk to, but depending on who you talk to, some people will say the 34-inch Sony HD TV, I'm blanking on the manufacturer name. It's not XRTV.
My stepdad has one.
Oh, it's man.
No.
I'm doing the terrible thing of typing stuff into Google right now, but it's XBR 960 is the model number.
There we go. That sounds right.
Yeah, and it's like 200. It's literally 220 pounds. Incredibly awkward to move. And the only time I would really go with that one instead of like just a standard 4x3 is that if you're gonna want to hook up your current gen stuff, like your Xbox 360 and your PS3 to it, because they just look so great. People will talk about black levels and things like that and how they are not so great on current HD TVs unless you go with a plasma. That's what they're, you know, really getting out of a 34-inch Sony tube TV. And again, I think it's like kind of overkill. I currently am running a 32-inch Trinitron, and everything looks fantastic. It has S-video input. It has component, which is kind of like your HD, and then composite, which is your yellow, red, and white. And it gives you plenty of options, a bunch of inputs, and you're going to be good to go.
Yeah, that's something to consider. Is most likely, if you're listening to this podcast, and this is a topic that's really important to you, is sort of the ideal retro game setup, then you're going to be happier with a 4:3 CRT TV anyway, because For one thing, it's not going to cost you as much money, and it's going to be the image that you need it to be anyway. And so that's where, like Kevin was just talking about, inputs start to be really important. You know, does it have an S video input on it? Because that can be a real difference maker for some of these old consoles.
Yeah, and the best part about like CRTs is that you can get them for free. People are trying to get rid of them. They take up
yes.
too much space. And if you look on Craigslist and you're patient, you will find, like, I've seen that XBR for free. Like, people are like, just make sure you bring someone to carry it out with you because I ain't helping you, and take it out of my house. Because HD TVs are so cheap these days, and there's just such a small market for people that want CRTs.
That's right. I was just looking on Craigslist yesterday, and I live in the deep south again. And, you know, there's the whole thing about southern hospitality. Mm-hmm. And someone was saying he had a really nice TV. It was a Sony. I can't remember exactly which one it was. It wasn't a Trinitron. But he had a Sony. It was a flat screen 4:3 CRT. And I think it was like 30 inches or 32 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was selling it for like $20, and he would deliver it to you if you needed him to, he said. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you never know what you might find on Craigslist. I mean, at the same time, that could have been a plot to do who knows what to you. But the point is that people really view you taking these TVs as a service to them, and then you're getting something that's going to make your retro games look completely awesome. So don't be afraid of Craigslist. You can look in the free stuff section, or you can look in the electronics section or somewhere else where I tend to see people talking about that. That those tend to be. Is there a dedicated television section, Kevin? Do you know?
Of Craigslist?
Yeah.
No, just electronics.
Yeah, just electronics, right?
Just
so
CRT or tube. Most people are gonna you want to probably search for tube. A lot of people won't know they're called CRTs.
Yeah, yeah, that stands for cathode ray tube. By the way, if anyone cares,
I do. So let's let's talk about like the next option. That's the best of the best. If you can get that, if you have the room for it, if you don't mind picking it up, that would be the best option. The second best is something that I just picked up in Japan, and it's something that I swear to God, every single time I come here, I see it at the Trader store. Trader's like a store chain that sells used stuff, and it's called the XRGB Framemeister, and it's made by Micom Soft, and what it is a upscaler specifically made for retro gamers, and that's like the great thing about Japan is that there's actually a market for something like this. And my buddy that I'm staying with, he ordered it directly shipped by Amazon Japan, and showed up at his house, and it runs about $300. You know, it's not cheap, but it is nice and small and compact, and it's just a great little product. It's called the Framemeister.
So I want you to so the idea with this mm-hmm. is that you're hooking it up to a like an LCD or a plasma or exactly. LED HDTV, mm-hmm. And so that you don't want it to look, because this is one thing we haven't said yet. Those of you who have hooked up your Sega Genesis or whatever older console to your Samsung or any brand HDTV, if it's mm-hmm. you know a thin LCD or plasma or whatever, it's going to look pretty bad. Just bottom line, they weren't designed with retro games in mind, and that's perfectly fine. That was not the original purpose, and it starts to show really quickly. And so the Framemeister is designed to get around that. So yeah, tell me a little bit about it. I'm really intrigued by this.
Yeah, so basically when you're looking at hooking up a console, your Super Nintendo, your N64, whatever, to an HDTV, you're going to be going through either a composite, and if you're lucky, most HDTVs sold today don't even have S-Video. They just have composite right. for legacy legacy products, like if you need to hook up a VHS or something like that. And what the Framemeister is doing was it's upscaling instead of, again, you plug in the signal that you're getting out of, say, a Super Nintendo is 240i, okay? And the best that your TV can do is 480i, so it's automatically going to be doubling the resolution. And, you know, technically, I might not be 100% correct, but with the technical part of this, but, and also I should preface, I'm like the third day here in Japan. I'm a little jet lagged, so if I sound a little groggy, that's why. I'm sorry. I'm doing my best. Mm-hmm. And so again, you hook up that 240 signal, or you're outputting that 240 signal to a TV that is basically only capable of getting 480 is like its minimum. You're going to be getting lots of kind of like washed out textures and things like that. You're obviously not going to have what you would consider to be the lines, like the scan lines and the individual pixels, like almost like the chunkiness, the sharpness that you would get out of a CRT. What the FrameMeister does is it first upscales it to a minimum of a 480 signal. So it's something that your TV is way happier with. Mm-hmm. That's going to make it look better right off the bat. The other thing that it's going to do is give you the option to add in scan lines. And when you add in scan lines, just like a lot like emulation on a computer, you're going to get a much sharper looking picture. You're going to get the, you know, the blockiness. Like if you think about looking at the like pixel art and stuff like that, like that's what we're talking about. Instead of like having to be all washed out, you're almost going to get something that's going to look a little bit more pixelated and more like the original. And it does a really good job at that. And I'm hooking up, like since I've been here, I picked up a Super Famicom and a N64, and hooking that stuff up just via composite. And we're not even talking about the options. Well, there's other options that you can use for inputs as well, but just hooking up through composite, adding in scan lines and messing with the settings a little bit. It is like if you are, like my buddy has a 40-inch LCD. If I am about 3 feet from it, it looks like it's on a CRT. It's like gross. Oh. It's unbelievable. And the other reason why, like, this is a product made for gamers, like people that want to hook up, like if you go on Amazon Japan and you look at the FrameMeister, the second thing like that will say is like people also bought such and such is something called a SCART cable for Sega Saturn. And they also make them for Super Nintendo. Like, Nintendo actually made this. It's an official product. And you can still buy this stuff brand new from Amazon. I think the SCART cable is, I think it was like $22 from Amazon for the Super Nintendo and or Super Famicom. And what it basically does is it gives you a component-type output, which is going to be like basically splitting up your red, blue, and your green signals from your Super Famicom, and then it can go into the FrameMeister, and it looks so freaking crisp. I think it looks better than, at least from the videos that I've seen of like what people get out of the Wii emulation. And
then you're not dealing with the issues of emulation at the same time.
Exactly. And again, that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about in a little bit, but emulation is just our emulation or, digital versions of games or something that's another discussion that we're going to have. But again, with the FrameMeister, you're spending $300 to get that option, to get the option to have scan lines, the option to also have minimal lag. And you got to understand, like, the FrameMeister is doing work. Like, it is doing, it is upscaling. That is something that is not just like an analog thing. It's doing a digital process. So it's doing work before it puts the signal back into the TV. And again, the reason why it's such a great product and such a popular product is that the lag is so minimal, you don't even notice it. Like, I was playing like Super Metroid, and like obviously the jumps and the shooting is very important to be precise. I've had no problem with it whatsoever. So it's like almost perfect.
I want to ask you, and see, that's such a glorious thing, because I have a funny feeling that people who are into retro gaming to this degree, to actually pay for a FrameMeister, certainly notice input lag. I would think that that's something that they really get. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, is you were talking about changing the settings on the FrameMeister in terms of adding scan lines and stuff like that. So how do you do that? Is that like an interface you have to go in through like on a PC, or is it as simple as just like flipping a switch on the box itself?
Well, the cool thing about this product is it's like the fourth generation of upscalers that this company has made, and they really have it down to a science right now. So it actually comes with a remote. The remote is all in Japanese, but you can go and get an overlay, And the great thing about this product, again, is that it is so popular that it has created communities that have translated all the buttons that are on the remote. They have, if you go on eBay, you can even get overlays that you can put on top of the remote, and it will basically just have the English names to it. And also you can find plenty of, websites that have, and even what I've been using a lot of, when I you pick it up and it's obviously a little bit intimidating because everything's in Japanese, all of the languages in Japanese. But what I've been using is JunkerHQ.net has a wiki that has like tons of walkthroughs on how to set this thing up. Also, how to upgrade the firmware, which it actually has a micro SD card slot in the back, where you can download new firmware, put the card into the back of the FrameMeister, and you just power it on, and it automatically upgrades the firmware.
Nice.
And the latest firmware also has the option for English menus. So if you can find the menu button on the remote, you automatically are going to be pretty much good to go because now all the menus for the FrameMeister on the TV are going to be in English.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get around that way. And also, like I said, there's pictures on the internet. If you just type in FrameMeister, you're going to find another website at retrogaming.hazard-city.de. And I'll put all these links in the show notes where it actually has a picture where it just translates all the buttons on the remote too. So if you just want to like look at that picture and then look at the remote, you can just match up the buttons and change the settings that way. And you know, it really isn't that difficult. It probably took like 5 minutes to set up to get the settings the way I wanted them to look.
Oh, nice.
And then you're off and running. And again, like, it was weird. Like, I was playing WrestleMania 2000 on N64 today. I'm like, man, this just like looks perfect. And it's through composite. It's not even S-Video. It's not even through the SCART cable. So I can't wait to get my hands on that on Wednesday and give that a shot to see what it really does.
Yeah, and I don't know. We've defined a lot of stuff along the way, but I just want to say, surely people who listen to this know, but just in case, composite is just when you're talking about yellow, white, red, mm-hmm. right? Not the one coaxial cable like that you'll use with NES, for instance.
Yeah,
and
Atari 2600 would not work on this thing because that's all it has for an output. You have to have a RCA output for it to be good to go.
Okay, so that's really your only option, which is fine because that still leaves you with a ton of consoles and options that you can use. And so S-Video is the one where you have yellow, white, red, and then you're adding this extra cable.
Yeah, that actually splits up the signals too. It does a pretty good job. But if you look at an S-Video plug, you'll notice that there's five plugs for your audio channels, and then it splits up the video channels as well, which is why it's such a big step up from composite.
Yeah, and even that, because of that reason, adds so much. And you can find that pretty easily for a lot of consoles, like the Dreamcast, for instance. And you were talking about SCART cables, and that's the one that I'm not as familiar with. And you were talking about how it splits up the green, blue, and red, I believe you said, was the other.
It's basically the best output that you can get. And the thing is that they're not super easy to get in America. You can order them through eBay, and you can find them for like most later consoles, like Super Nintendo, Sega Saturn. You know, people, if you own a Sega Saturn and you really like your Sega Saturn, this is going to be a fantastic product for you because you can get a SCART output for that too. And then once you get to things like, you know, the PlayStation 2, get to GameCube that have component outputs, which is your red, blue, and green video outputs. You can then get that converter that will convert that to SCART and then plug that in, and like your Wii will just look like gross. Like it will look so good on your HDTV where, it's like, I was kind of hesitant. Like I said, I've gone to Japan. This is my fifth time here. And every single time I've come, I've looked at that thing in the store and be like, man, do I really want to spend like $300 on that thing?
Right, because that is an investment. It's much more than you'd be paying for a CRT TV, for instance.
For sure, and I figured, well, I'm going to be out here for like a month anyway, so I don't want to play my retro stuff on a gross-looking HD TV. And now that I have this thing, you know, I can consider getting rid of my CRT, and that's room for one more arcade machine or something like that, or it's just getting it out of my house and opening up room in my living room. So that's also another benefit. Is it just like, if you have the money, it will save you a bunch of space.
That's an interesting thing to think about, and I had not thought about that just yet. My wife is very cool with my retro gaming interests and doesn't mind me having a room where I have a CRT TV hooked up and all that. But I know that some people are in relationships, and that it's not as convenient for them. The person doesn't really appreciate having a huge, you know, 220-pound TV sitting around in a room, as opposed to a nice, like, wall-mounted HD TV. So this is sort of a compromise, the FrameMeister. That would be a way to pitch it, so that you can bring the FrameMeister home and make everyone happy. You still get to play your retro stuff, but you don't have the huge CRT TV at home. So, you know, something to think about for those of you who are in relationships and have to consider that angle.
Exactly. Like I said before, I apologize for sounding foggy-headed. It's just been a long couple days. But anyways, the next thing that we're going to be talking about is like emulation, because one of the things that I'm a huge proponent of is owning the actual games. Like, hey, obviously, if you go the emulation route, you know, something like the FrameMeister, not really needed, because if you're playing through like the Wii Virtual Console, the emulation is actually doing a really good job. Like, Virtual Console games look really good on an HDTV, even more so on the Wii U. And that's, again, one option. Same thing if you're going on a PC and you're emulating games on a PC. It gives you options for scan lines. And then there's retro gaming collections like Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection, which gives you a couple options for smoothing and sharpness and things like that. And but still, like, even like the Sonic's Ultimate Genesis Collection, I don't think looks great. It's better than others, but it's not like. And another thing that's super cool about Stan here is I didn't even know this, but my buddy has like the Sega Ages Collection version of Golden Axe for the PS2, and that's something that we'll talk about later when we start talking about Japan. But like, the problem with a lot of the re-releases and stuff like that is that the companies don't always put in the time to make it look good. Like, if you think about when Symphony of the Night came out on Xbox 360, what that kind of looked like, and there was some complaints that people thought it looked oversaturated and it looked really bad when it was, you know, upscaled and things like that.
Yeah, a la carte looked brown.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a big deal. And I think when you have the actual carts, they're going to take up more space, and they're going to be a little bit more expensive sometimes. But in the end, think about this. You're never going to like think about, man, I don't have my Wii anymore, so I don't have access to my virtual console stuff. Or, man, going from PS3 to PS4, I'm either going to have to keep this PS3 or I'm not going to be able to play all that stuff I downloaded off PSN. Same thing with Xbox 360. So that becomes almost like a rental in that case. This stuff you can own, you can resell, you can trade it with a friend, you can, you know, do stuff like hook it up to a FrameMeister. Like, you have a lot of different options. And I think with emulation through legit means, is just still a little bit too sketchy for my taste, and I still do it. Like, I just downloaded Zelda 2 on the 3DS last night because I need it for a special episode that it looks like we're going to be doing, and I'm very excited.
Oh,
about.
Wow.
but the, you know, that's still a hurdle, or it's still going to be a consideration for people out there.
I will say, you just kind of hit on something I wanted to talk about, and that's, you know, legitimate emulation. We're not talking about piracy here, but legitimate emulation, which is stuff like Wii Virtual Console, PSN, Xbox Live Arcade, and services like that, good old games, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think that the best case for that, because I'm with Kevin, that anytime you can have the cart, you absolutely should have the cart or the CD or whatever format it was on. But
well, I will step in real quick, and I think if you – I would watch out. We talked about this, I think, last time, but any kind of like disc-based stuff, you're going to be threatened by disc rot, Dreamcast stuff
true.
Especially. So I would just be super, super safe. Like I think we talked about last week, the cool thing about carts is that they are – ROM based, and you know there are arcade boards from the 60s that are still working perfectly, or they're at least repairable, and you know even NES games are like 30 years old max, so they're going to have a much longer shelf life for you.
Yeah, timeless in terms of functionality, timeless in terms of look as well. I love carts, awesome. And yeah. I know, and a lot of it's nostalgia, which is, hey, we celebrate nostalgia on this podcast, so that's good. But yeah, there's just something about them. They just look great. What I was going to say, though, is that I think the best case for downloading these games is kind of like what Kevin's going through right now of playing Zelda 2 on the 3DS, and I said going through because he's playing Zelda 2, is that it's great to download these games for handhelds. Right, like if I'm going to download it, that's a great place to have it, because these games often really hold up well for travel, or for if someone else is occupying the main TV or whatever. These are, or, you know, if you're going to be on a flight or on a train or whatever for a while, these games often lend themselves well to that. Are you still there?
Mm-hmm. I am. Sorry, I was muting myself so I could drink water.
Sorry to freak out. Okay, cool. I won't freak out next time that happens. Anyway, they lend themselves really well to that with the pick-up-and-play style of gaming that we're talking about with a lot of the games from the 8-bit and 16-bit generation. And then when you factor in not save states, I'm not talking about saving and then being able to repeat and repeat and repeat and kind of break the game in a way that it wasn't meant to be played for difficult games. I just mean being able to stop wherever you want to stop and just close the 3DS for a few minutes or put the PSP in standby mode or whatever. And then get back to it when you get another chance. These things could be really nice. So I recommend these if you're going to download emulated versions, get them on the handhelds. And Kevin was talking a minute ago about Wii U having a fairly nice looking virtual console, like the games that are on that, that they actually look good on your TV is what we're talking about. Not that the lineup is good, because obviously it isn't right now. But you can play those games just on the gamepad. And they automatically are in 4:3 on the gamepad. They don't stretch them or anything like that. And you have speakers built into it and a pretty solid D-pad and buttons. So that's another route to consider if for some reason you like don't want to pay maybe $200 for Earthbound. That's a really nice way to play it. It's just in the palm of your hand. But otherwise, if it's $20 or less, get the cart. You're going to have a way better experience. And then you can get the FrameMeister and sort of... it's kind of like remixing a little bit, you know, adding scan lines and all that stuff. It just, oh, that's cool. I'm extremely jealous.
Well, I will, I'm going to try to put together a video while I'm here about some of the FrameMeister stuff so people can get a more in-depth look at it and what it's capable of doing. But,
do you get what I was saying though, Kevin, about, why the handhelds are a really nice space for these games? If you do want to download them somewhere, that's probably the best place to have them.
Yeah, and that's why it was great on my flight on my PSP. I could play through the Neo Geo collection, and I played the crap out of that thing. Like, it was you know, a lot of fun, because like you said, some of the older stuff is good for bite-sized gaming time and things like that. And they're
yeah, even if they weren't like handheld games originally, they yeah. You know, they often are great bite-sized games.
Well, because they're based more on shallow.
Right. Yeah, sometimes the experience, and that's not necessarily to its detriment, but shallow in terms of it's just a very focused experience.
And you don't need super HD amazing graphics to watch it, you know, to appreciate the visual. The visual style of the game. So, again, last thing I wanted to kind of mention about that competition is, like, I hate things like the multi-carts, like for Neo Geo, like I'm so pumped that I was able to go buy Neo Geo carts like at a store in like in real life. So
that's cool.
That I mean, that was a lot of fun, but I think you got to like keep in mind that if you go and you download every single Super Nintendo ROM or every single Genesis ROM, you're just going to be overwhelmed and you're not going to really get that kind of focused in experience, at least in my experience. So that's the last thing I wanted to hit on. So what we're going to do right now, let's take a quick break and then we're going to be right back with talking really about so many different things about retro games. So just stick around. We're going to be back in just a second. Okay, we're back, and one of the big things, like I said, people wanted to hear talked about since I was going out to Japan is kind of like what like culture and life is out here for gamers and stuff like that. And one of the big things, and one of my like the big things that I'm drawn to when I come to Japan is like that. Almost like it's all over the place in the acceptance and that it is just a part of like, it's like buying CDs or it's like listening to music. Everyone plays games. And, I mean, you can see it in with arcades being all over the place. Like you see game centers all over where they have, you know, everything from UFO catchers, which is like your crane games to, card-based games, almost like what was that card-based game for the PS3? Do you remember that thing?
Oh, Eye of Judgment?
Yeah, like Eye of Judgment. And even like soccer-based card games, and that's like such a huge market out here. Also, your obvious things like your Street Fighters and your latest Tekken and Virtual Fighter games, and even some retro stuff where you'll like if you'll see a lot of arcades that will have a section just for old things like Neo Geo games or Final Fight or things of that like. And then there's also obviously the vertical shooters and horizontal shooters that are still huge. Like they still come out all the time and people are always playing those, like those bullet hell shooters.
Oh yeah, do they have the screens like where they're actually kind of on their sides for the vertical ones?
Oh yeah,
so that they're really tall.
Yes,
you know what I'm talking about.
So with the main cabinets that you're going to find in Japan are going to be Sega, Astro Cities, Sega Blast Cities, and those are just kind of like the models of the arcade machines. And the cabinets are really cool because they're just meant to be generic. They're meant to be swapped, you know, have boards swapped in and out of them. And the monitor is actually capable of being rotated. So it has brackets set up to flip or take the monitor out and then orient it horizontally or vertically based on the game that you're going to be playing.
Wow, that's so cool to imagine playing like Ikaruga that way.
Yeah. And I mean, they do you know, they take great care of the stuff. Like you can still, you know, people are always smoking. That's the only probably bad part is that the arcades allow smoking for the most part. So it is not as fun to stay in there for long periods of time if you're not a smoker, but it's still pretty cool.
What sorts of hours do these game centers run?
Like
that you picked up on?
Like usually something like 10 a.m. to midnight, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., something like that.
Oh, cool. So it's not like something that you can only do during the daytime. It's not being just positioned like for kids, like something like this would be in the United States.
No. There's so many. I mean, you hear people talk about it all the time, but there's so many businessmen and just regular people will just go in and play a couple games. There's always women are always trying to like play the UFO catchers and stuff like that on Like, we went to Akihabara on a Saturday, and it was just packed. Like, the Sega, the main, like, game centers you'll see a lot are either Taito Game Stations or Sega Club Segas. Those are, like, the two franchised game centers that you'll see. And the first floor will always be your UFO catchers, and then as you go higher and higher, you'll get pretty much into the more hardcore stuff. And, like, the UFO catchers are super popular. There's amazing prizes, like really great prizes that you can get out of them. And it's a huge fanfare when you win something. Like, the employee, like, they're fully staffed. Staffs at these places are fantastic. And if you win something, they'll, like, come up to you and they'll, like, congratulate you, and then they'll give you a bag to carry it home in, so you don't have to, like, carry this thing, like, boxy thing around. Like, they're really, really cool. So, I mean, that's one of the first thing that you'll be kind of struck with. It's like, man, there's actually arcades around here. There's cool things, like an incredibly popular TV show that's on its, like, 11th season, called Game Center CX, which we saw some part of it come over through Kotaku. They did some pretty much like a bad translation of the show, I guess, or at least some people say it's a bad translation. They did voiceover for all of the stuff, and it did not come over great. But if you go to gamingcx.com, it's a website that has translated versions of, I think, over 100 episodes of the show, and it's just text translation, so subtitles, instead of somebody like doing a voice dub of the Kacho Chief Arena. So it's a much better way to check it out, but that's won't get into all this stuff. But the big things that we're going to be talking about is really used game shops and the fact that they are all over the place. And it's really not just used game shops, it's just used in general. Like, there's still a gigantic market, and there's a big part about Japan is just having used stores in general for buying books, DVDs, CDs, even VHS tapes, hardware, and even like home goods and stuff like that.
Yeah, and that's such a cool thing, and it's something that I love eBay, and I think almost all of us do who are into retro games. But I feel like, well, I don't even just feel like, I've watched this happen in over the last 15 years of used shops sort of going away. That especially the used shops that really focus on media, you know, on CDs, on DVDs, on movies, on video games. You just don't see them as much anymore. And there's a really great chain, I've talked about it before, called Half Price Books, that's in parts of the United States. There's a ton of them in Texas. There's some throughout the Northeast and the Midwest, but I think that's about it. They are really large stores, like closer to the size of a Target, and they have big use sections for everything. So for video games, for vinyl, for comic books, for music, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a really cool place. But other than that, if you're in the United States, you're pretty much just limited to pawn shops and the occasional place like Half Price Books or Hastings, which doesn't have a great retro selection by any means. And GameStop no longer sells retro games. So that's just something that's really cool to me to hear, that you can just walk around where you are right now in Japan and find these places, and to see that that's something that's really valued in the culture.
Yeah, so you know, again, when people talk about Japan, they talk about going to Akihabara, because that is, if you don't know already, you probably do, it's Electric Town, and that's where like all the electronic stuff are. But in the last 10 years or so, it's transitioned to have a ton more anime stuff, more like hentai porn shops and stuff like that, literally. And it is an interesting crowd of people there. It is, again, very few or fewer game shops and more just like model shops for like mechs, like building mechs or like building your own models, and hobby shops, things like that. And things like Hatsune Miku and Club Diva places, like all that stuff that in America we might not understand, but it is still a big part of Japanese culture. And oh, go ahead.
Oh, and that's when you really start getting into the acceptance thing, right? Just that.
I mean, acceptance is one thing. Being part of the culture is another. Like, I think it's still a lot of the adult Japan kind of looks down on it. But the it's amazing when you kind of still see, like, you'll see on the flight out to Japan from Boston, I saw a guy in his 40s with his wife. He pulled out a PSP and he was playing Hatsune Miku on his PSP, and like just the right sight that brought.
Yeah, and so tell the audience a little bit about Hatsune Miku for those who don't know. It's I know it kind of has a cult following in the United States, but it's not really a big name over here yet.
Okay, so again, I apologize if we're not super focused on this episode. We're just kind of going kind of broad and just having a discussion more than anything. That's why this is going to be just like a bonus episode. But the female groups, like think of Spice Girls, think of TLC that we had. Like,
and I'm always thinking about TLC, yeah, so that's convenient.
Destiny's Child, like female band, like groups like Backstreet Boys and stuff like that. Like, those are gigantic here. The biggest one is easily AKB48. And their popularity is incredible. And basically stuff like Project Diva and Hatsune Miku, honestly, I can't give a great detailed description because I have never touched the games, but they are mostly like an anime version of those groups where you can like customize, and then you can play kind of rhythm based games based on, you know, those fictional anime musical groups, if that, you know, might sound weird, but
that's a good description. That's the way I understand it as well. And I know a lot of people have figured out ways to play those games on their US systems.
Yeah,
so.
Like their hardware sellers, like for the PlayStation Vita, like that was one of the big pushes that it got a couple months back, is that I think it was either Hatsune Miku or Project Diva game came out for it and got a huge boost in hardware sales.
And that's a system that's been dead in the United States for 3 years, you know?
It's doing okay here right now, though. It's all over the place. And I've been really close to buying a Red Vita. I haven't done it yet. I haven't pulled the trigger, but those things are super hot looking. So, you know, again, kind of talking about these retro shops, they're the main things that you're going to want to go to and think about. If you're going to be going to Japan, Akihabara is going to be the first place that you go to. And these, I'm going to give you the rundown. These are the four stores that you have to check out. And in order of from shit to great. Because and it's based on like pricing, okay? So the one that everyone always talks about is Super Potato. That is like the mainstay that you're gonna go to. And with Super Potato, you're gonna have an incredible selection, but you're gonna have prices that are gonna be a little bit higher, okay? And it's also super packed, so if you go in there on a Sunday, good luck looking at stuff. It's just going to be overwhelming. Like, we went on Saturday, and I went into the floor that has, like, the 8-bit to 16-bit stuff, and I was just like, it's not even worth going in there because it is so packed. If you have I have a backpack on, like, it's just impossible to get through the crowds. And when it's super humid and you're kind of around some guys that are kind of nerdy, their hygiene might not be up to snuff.
And, I've never heard of this, Kevin.
Yeah, and it was like, man, like, I walked into that floor, I'm like, oh my god, it smells so bad in here. I'm just gonna like turn around and leave. So that's Super Potato. The other one that I would heavily recommend, and this is kind of like the happy medium, is Trader. And Trader is, again, one of those cool chains, because you're going to see there's three Trader stores on the same street. And there's basically Trader, Trader 2, and Trader 3. Trader 3 has been shut down, though. Or at least it was shut down on Saturday. It was closed. I don't know if they shut down the location, but the Trader One is what you want to go to. And on the second floor, they're going to have all their retro stuff. And again, that's kind of cool. You can just like go to a floor that's just exclusively retro stuff. Inside the Trader store, the first thing that you're probably going to notice is what's called the junk bin. And the junk bin has a bunch of Famicom, Super Famicom, Mega Drive, TurboGrafx, Game Boy stuff. And it's basically stuff that's sold without a guarantee. It's stuff that is not up to a quality where they are willing to sell it to people as a loose cart. That's another aspect. You know,
so like how low will the prices be on some of that stuff?
Famicom games for 50 yen, 100 yen, 250 tops. I can get a copy of Super Mario Brothers 3 for 250 yen. It's going to be scuffed up. It's not going to be really clean. But you take a Q-tip with some rubbing alcohol, put it on it, you'll easily be able to play it. And everything that I've ever bought from the junk bin has worked. Like, it's not that it doesn't work. It's just that it's not cosmetically super appealing. And like we were talking off the air about Famicom carts, they're all different colors. So if you can get like a black cart that might be in the junk bin, to be honest, it's really not going to like look bad aesthetically.
Whereas so, a yellow cart will be
yeah, a yellow cart brutal. Or like a red one or a white one might not look so good. So yeah. That's something to keep in mind. But even like Game Boy stuff, if it's loose, like you're talking like 50 yen, 100 yen for a Game Boy game that are region free. Like you can pick up some great games. Like I picked up, and this is at another store that we're going to talk about in a second, but picking up like Super Mario Land 1, 2, and 3 for a total of, I think, $7.
Oh,
which is pretty good. Like when you can get that stuff, and they were like, they look great. Like they didn't look bad at all, but they're just loose carts, so they're relatively cheap. There's an incredible wealth of selection when it comes to boxed games, and they're really not that much more expensive. Like you can get a box copy of The Legend of Zelda Link to the Past for like $15-$17, and you know, there's even games that are a little bit more common over here. Like you can get a box copy of Chrono Trigger for $5, box copy of Final Fantasy 3 or 2 or 4 or 6, depending on who you're where you're located, for under $5. Like it's pretty nuts. And loose copies of Final Fantasy 3 will go for like 200 yen, which is like $2. And you know, again, they're in Japanese, so it's a little bit more applicable, but you got to keep that in mind when it comes to like really popular stuff and even like weird stuff. Like you get like when if you want to copy a Mortal Kombat 2 for Super Famicom, it's like 50 yen, like in good shape, because Japanese people just don't want it. Same thing like finding a copy of NBA Jam. Like think of American arcade games, Smash TV 2, or I should say as well, and Final Fight. Like all these games are just super, super cheap over here compared to their U.S. counterparts, and that's one of the real benefits of buying stuff over here, is that you can get things for a lot cheaper, like Dracula X Chronicles or for Super Famicom, you can get for like $22, where the U.S. version loose is like $150 on eBay. And it's obviously the same exact game. You just need to either mod your Super Nintendo or you have to have a Super Famicom.
So is the issue with Dracula X that it just sold so well in Japan that there's just a lot of copies out there?
Yeah, there's tons of copies. It didn't really sell great in the United States, and you know,
That's where the cultural taste come into play, right? You have to think about, well, what's popular, what's not popular in the U.S. might be really popular in Japan. So then you could find that stuff in a game lot on eBay or just in a random retro shop like you have.
For sure. And like, I think, again, it's one of those things that you can almost justify a trip out here. Like, man, I'm going to save so much money on games. And also I can do all this touristy stuff too. It almost like justifies the flight. So, that's Trader. The other store that I want to talk about is Book Off, which is actually kind of like Half Price Books, where Book Off, they are all over the place. Like, seriously, they are in every city you go to or every prefecture in Japan, you're going to find Book Off. And you're going to go in there, and a lot of times you'll find those junk bins as well, where you'll find games for 100 yen, 200 yen, like $1, $2. And Super Famicom games, I got a bunch of Sega Saturn games for 200 yen, a bunch of TurboGrafx games for 100 yen a piece.
Wow.
It's just kind of gross, and they're not bad games. Like we're just talking super common games. Like you're talking Virtua Fighter 2, or you're talking Sega Rally, or you're talking about stuff like Virtual Cop. Like maybe it's stuff that's not like super rare, but you can pick it up, and still it is a fantastic game. Even the TurboGrafx stuff, like finding like Bonk for 200 yen loose, like it's not hard to find stuff like that,
right? And whereas that's a console that didn't even do well in the United States, you know, we're not even talking about a mm-hmm. game in this case, we're talking about an entire console that you never see at retro shops in the US. So that's super cool to be able to find that stuff.
And again, like with Book Off, it's again another just option where you can do price comparing. But sticking with Akihabara, the last place that I will mention and my favorite place is a place called Friends, and it's all the way at the end of the main street, and it's like kind of actually hard to find. It was one place that the first time that I was out here, I spent, I'm not kidding, like 5 hours walking around the city trying to look for Super Potato, and I couldn't find it because I didn't realized to look up for the sign for it, and I stumbled over onto the store, just kind of going grid based on through the city, and it was like heaven. Everything was super clean. It's run by these this old Japanese woman, an old Japanese man, and they clean everything. Everything is in great shape, and the prices are just fantastic. The selection is great, and it's where I spent the majority of my money the first day I was here, just because you can buy everything for so cheap.
Why is their stuff so much cheaper? Do you think it's just a conscious effort to try to garner business, to try to gain an audience?
No, well, it's just like it's just a mom and pop shop. And, you know, I don't know how they get this stuff. I don't know if people are trading it in or if they go through some kind of like bulk dealer. But they just do. And I'm guessing their overhead is not as much since it's like a really small store. That's just like wall to wall video games. And, there tends to not be as much traffic in there. And I don't think the selection is not as great as the other stores, but, if you find something there, like, if you like listen to watch Giant Bomb stuff, you always hear like Tetris Battle Gaiden, like that's 500 yen there, 600 yen, and it is just such a cool game. Same thing with picking up like Yoshi's Island is $5. Picking up, they have a great selection of Famicom discs. They have, they actually had hardware there. I actually bought my Super Famicom there this time, and it is really cheap. And again, I honestly I go there and I just, the woman there has been so nice to me every single time I've gone there, and understanding that I don't speak Japanese, and she's just always, you know, very polite when I ask about stuff. Like I'll just be like, you know, Sima-sen, and just say like a game name, and she's just very helpful. So I'm really more inclined to just give them my money. Because they don't take credit card, like they only take cash. Like it's one of those places that don't even like you can't even pay with a credit card. You just have to pay cash, and it's just it's a better experience there because it's also a quiet store. Like it's not overwhelmed. It's just you can kind of just spend, you know, take your time and look at stuff.
Right, because that's the last thing you want is to be looking through a big bin of things, you know, and not knowing what's going to be in any given bin, because usually these aren't alphabetically organized or anything. And to have somebody, you know, standing literally right behind you, you know, with their head on your shoulder, breathing on your neck, that's a really bad way to do this because it just pressures you and it makes you feel like you have to just keep moving. So this store sounds ideal. So is it actually called Friends, like, or is that the translation of the word and roughly translate?
I believe it's actually just called Friends or Friendship or something. I think it's Friends.
That's awesome. I would, you know, then they actually have that vibe, that friendly vibe, and they they clean the games and everything. It sounds like they are really doing business the right way.
Yeah, whenever you see the woman behind the counter, she's just constantly cleaning games. Like, she cleans the cases and then the contacts. And, you know, again, it's just such a weird experience. Like, you, again, coming from the United States where you can't find this stuff. And if you find a retro game shop in the United States, it's probably shit. It's probably overpriced. The people that work there are probably not always the nicest people. They're usually not making tons of money off their games either.
Right. And on the pricing issue, I think, is the big thing. Is that, yeah, most larger cities in the United States, you know, I'm talking about cities that have at least 200,000 people or more, I've noticed tend to have some sort of retro shop. But, you know, I don't want to pay $40 for Zombies Ate My Neighbors, which I just encountered that a few days ago. Like, yes, you might be able to find some of this stuff in the shops, but it's not going to be clean and it's going to be really expensive. So it's not really a very a joyous experience. And that's something that I want to ask you about. And you've kind of alluded to it a couple of times. Is this experience of walking into a store like Friends or Friendship, whatever it's called, and just seeing like wall to wall games? Like, I know that the store itself isn't very big, but like, How strange is that? Is it overwhelming? Is it fun?
It's totally overwhelming.
Dust in hand.
It's overwhelmingly fun. It's like you go in there and you're just like, I don't even know where to start. Oh man, let's just start in the Famicom section. We'll just kind of work our way around. And there's just so much stuff in there. And it's like, I wish I had unlimited money because I just keep buying stuff. And I also am going to keep in mind how much I can fit in my luggage on the way home. And the I mean, the main thing is just make sure you just like take a deep breath and just kind of take your time. And it's honestly, it's like almost a dream for people that like retro games like us. And it's just so cool to just spend like half an hour going through just one section, like going through their Super Famicom section, looking at every game. Like, will take you 15, 20 minutes because there's so much stuff. And you'll end up like almost like holding a baby's worth of games, you know, like in your arms, just trying to like bring them up to the counter and, trying to buy this stuff. And it's like one of those things that, is so weird is that I'm staying in Koshigaya, which is like an hour outside of Tokyo. It's like suburban Japan. And just biking around, we found a used shop that just has like two huge rows of retro games, like Sega Saturn, TurboGrafx, Famicom, Super Famicom, Mega Drive stuff. And just like to find that, I'm like, I don't even know where to start. It's like, it's just so crazy that you can just find stuff like this and just find like crazy deals on stuff. Like finding, like they had a Neo Geo CD complete, like everything, and it looked perfect for $60. Like it's.
Oh, and how much does that go for on eBay?
Like $200. Like,
yeah, I'm thinking well over double that.
Yeah, so I'm trying to like convince myself because now that I own a Neo Geo arcade machine, I shouldn't need that stuff. But I'm like, oh man, how can I, like, I want to buy it. I want to buy it so bad, but I shouldn't. And again, this is my every 30 minutes apologizing because I'm super jet lagged and I know I sound like super weird right now, but it's because, and I feel like I'm going to fall asleep as I'm talking and it's like 10 a.m. in Japan right now. But, that's another big thing. And, and the cool thing about that location is right next to it is this place called G-Front, and it has all arcade boards and like two huge bins of Neo Geo carts. And I bought a bunch of Neo Geo carts there that, again, will go for about twice to three times as much of the price that I pay for them on eBay. And if you ever get a Neo Geo arcade machine, and same thing with the AES, the home carts, is that all the carts have all the languages on them. So if you get a Japanese version of a game and you plug it into your arcade machine back in the United States, even if it has a Japanese label, you're still going to get it in English. So there's no problem. And the quality of this stuff, like when you buy an MVS card on eBay for Neo Geo, good luck getting the mini marquee for it. And if it has a mini marquee, expect to pay a lot more. This stuff had the mini marquee. It had like the instruction cards if you were going to be putting it into a non-Neo Geo cabinet. Like the care that goes into preserving this stuff is just unbelievable. And it's just another step of like, man, I just can't believe that things are like it over here. And it's one of those things that you can really appreciate.
Yeah, that really is awesome. I think I just have this image of Scrooge McDuck from DuckTales, like just diving into his gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, like just thinking of all these games.
I mean, that's pretty much it. And again, I think it's one of the coolest things about coming over here is that crazy thing of being like, yeah, man, I've never seen TurboGrafx stuff. But then I walk into the store and they have like over 400 TurboGrafx cards. And then they also have like another 400 TurboGrafx CD games. And
yeah, it's no big deal to them.
Yeah. And if you need a TurboGrafx, like the hardware, it's just right in the back. They have like five of them to choose from. And they base the price on the condition of the console. So if it's scuffed up, it's cheaper. Like if a Super Nintendo or a Super Famicom is yellowed, it's a lot cheaper. And you have the ability, like you go to Super Potato, all the hardware is there. Like you can pick up anything you want if you want to pay the price for it. Famicom disc or Famicom twin systems, like all that stuff. I think the best thing to do, let's cut this episode, this part of the episode right here. I know I'm not sounding super great and I'm not feeling great. So,
you're doing a good job, man.
Yeah. I mean, physically, I'm not feeling very good. So, let's cut this part off. And, we have a bunch more that we want to talk about when it comes to this stuff, including like what to look out for here. So this will be the first part of the Japanese super fantastic gaming experience. And, we'll come back with part two, later, and we'll hopefully I'll sound better. I'll be in better shape. And what I want you to do is if you have any questions or things that you want to like have, that I can talk about in terms of like stuff out here in Japan, please, please, please post it in the, show notes in the comment section or submit it via the contact page on the website. Go into the NeoGAF thread and talk on there or just hit me up on Twitter at Kevin Larrabee and I'll be happy to hit on that stuff when we do the next part.
Yeah, and my Twitter is Joshua Hillier. That's two L's. And you can ask me these questions and I won't be able to answer them, but I'll make something up. So that's another approach.
No, I mean, it will just add to the discussion and just retro gaming in general, not just Japan, getting set up. And what we'll do is we'll probably do one more episode like this. And I can't really tease it, but there's some people out here that live in Japan that do a podcast that I'm in talks with, like serious talks about getting over to their place and recording an episode with them on a specific game that I alluded to. And that should be coming hopefully in the next like week or two, if we can pull it off. They're super busy right now, but hopefully we can pull this off and we'll have a special, like, what's this podcast called? Back in My Play Cross such and such podcast. So,
Yeah, Namco will be doing a version of that as well.
Yeah, exactly. So please subscribe through iTunes. Check us out at backinmyplay.com and submit a review if you haven't already. I'd really, really appreciate that coming in this fragile state on this Monday morning here in Japan where I haven't been sleeping the last 3 days and it's been incredibly hot. So thanks as always for listening. I apologize for any kind of sound stuff this episode. I'll do my best to clean up the AC noise. And until next time, I'm Kevin Larrabee, Josh Hillier, and we will, you know, catch you on the next flight to Japan, I guess. We'll see you next time.
Take care. We'll be right back.